From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. We have a good full show lined up for you this morning on this July 10th, 2020, Friday morning. We're going to be speaking first off with the Executive Director of the Vermont State Ethics Commission. The commission formed just a couple of years ago. Been a lot of criticisms directed at the way it's structured, that it doesn't have enough teeth, doesn't have enough transparency. We're going to be talking with Larry Novins about those issues. The commission is actually soliciting public comments now and asking for folks out there to weigh in on how it ought to change its structure and change it the way it operates. And we'll be talking about all that in the first half hour. In the 9:30 to 10 slot, we've got Linda Joy Sullivan joining us. She's a state rep from down in Dorset in southern Vermont, a Democrat. She is running to unseat veteran state auditor Doug Hoffer. And Linda Joy Sullivan will be talking to us about her candidacy for state auditor in that second half hour there. Bob Ney joins us after the top of the hour, one of our national correspondents. Bob's a real stalwart with the Dave Graham Show. He's been a consistent performer, and he actually has really excellent insights on what's going on in the national news scene. That'll be right after the mid-show break, typically about 10:05 or so. And then toward the latter part of the show, we'll be talking with Marilyn Cargill. She's a vice president at the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. And VSAC has some interesting information put out there about the fact that the coronavirus apparently is changing up some of the borderlines and strictures around student aid, student scholarships, grants and loans, et cetera. And folks may be in a period of greater generosity. And it may be even worth some students refiling for student aid and grants and loans, et cetera. They may get a better result than they got the first time around, according to what VSAC is telling us. We'll be talking with Marilyn Cargill of VSAC about that all together in the second hour this morning. But first, I believe we have Larry Novins on the phone with us this morning. Let's get right into our conversation about the State Ethics Commission. And Mr. Novins, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It's great to join you.
And let's talk about the Ethics Commission. It is, give us a little history first off. Do I have it right that it's about 2 years old?
Correct. Yeah, we're in our third full year now. So it started out as a hope and a dream, I think. And slowly over time, we were evolving and looking around and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work and trying to move forward to make ethics oversight in Vermont real. I think when the Ethics Commission was first envisioned, there were a lot of people with a lot of different views about what it should be doing and how it should operate. And what emerged from the legislature, I think, was a humble beginning that created the Ethics Commission and gave a certain authority. And among those authorities were to develop a code of ethics for the state. But in terms of what happens with ethics complaints, we were charged with taking those complaints and referring them to the people who would have gotten them before the Ethics Commission was created. So in terms of actual enforcement or oversight, there's really not any more now than there was before the commission was created. What one advantage of having the commission and having learned some lessons along the way is I think we have a much better view of the landscape and what's needed in Vermont and are in a good position to advocate for changes to make ethics oversight in Vermont meaningful.
It's interesting to me. I mean, I was a State House reporter for a long time for the Associated Press, ending in 2016, and I remember discussions about this, you know, earlier on. It kind of percolated along off and on for years, really. Should Vermont have an ethics commission? And there was a kind of a prevailing attitude for much of that time, which I guess is why it never happened until just a couple of years ago, that, you know, Vermont is an amazingly clean state when it comes to the ethics of elected officials, that we don't really need an ethics commission, that we have. And when people want to point to conflicts of interest and other ethical issues, oftentimes there's sort of a nice explanation for why something looks weird. You know, somebody's married to somebody or whatever, and that's just because we're a small state. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've heard all those kinds of lines of reasoning in the past. And I'm wondering, do you think that the Ethics Commission coming out of the blocks was a little hampered by maybe some of that attitude?
I think so. I think there was a perception, and I think it's essentially accurate that most people in state government are doing a good, hardworking, honest job. Mm-hmm. I think what sort of escaped from the conversation is, what do we do in those rare instances where someone isn't behaving ethically? And then also, I think that what really wasn't talked about is what is the benefit of having a real ethics code and a real ethics oversight. As you know, right now, the Ethics Commission has been charged by the legislature, was asked by the legislature. The actual bills didn't pass this last session, but we suggested to the legislature that we would be very happy to provide a code of ethics, a draft that they could adopt into statute. And our position was really, talk about ethics in state government without a code that's enforceable or have the force of law really makes no sense. That's the direction we're going in now, and we asked for public comment on this draft that we've come up with. The draft reflects basically what's in the codes of more than 40 other states that all do have the force of law, and reflects what's in federal rules. So I think, we're moving in a good direction. But what I think has not really been discussed very much is what is the benefit of having an ethics code? We talk about enforcement, and people say, well, we should be going after the people who are doing wrong. But I think that really misses a lot of the point. Is, having an ethics code is something that allows people in state government to make better decisions, to make a distinction between what is permissible and what is the better thing or the right thing to do. And an ethics code basically, I think, enhances a culture of ethical conduct. And if, as we talk about having an ethics code, and if we have one adopted by statute, it will raise awareness of ethics expectations. And that will lead, I hope, to better decision making when people in state government confront, the gray areas that happen every single day. And I think having a code and a culture of ethics will encourage people to ask questions about, their contemplated activities. If somebody's saying, well, I'm thinking of doing this, I wonder, is that a good idea or a bad idea? And if we have a code in statute, then people can look to it for guidance. And I think what the Ethics Commission would like to be more than anything else is a resource for people in state government and for the public so that we can help people reach the right decision. Our theory being that if people have a good code to go by, we can eliminate the need or at least diminish the need for enforcement. So I think that's, the really most important thing. An ethics code can really help people in state government. It not only, I think some people, are concerned that, every little step I make is going to be scrutinized and people are going to want to play gotcha. And I think really what the ethics code does is act as a shield for people in state government. If you're contemplating something, some activity, and you look at the code and the code says, not a good idea, you probably shouldn't go there, then you've got something to rely on. And the person who's asked you to do something, you can respond to them and say, our ethics code says that's not a good idea. I'm not going to do that. So I think the ethics code would be a great protection for people in state government. And our hope is that, that we'll be successful in giving the legislature a well-drafted code and that they will be able to pass it. And then at that point, we see the majority of our role is raising ethics awareness and through education and constant conversation and by being available to people in state government as a resource to help guide their decisions when they get into those, difficult gray areas.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, really, it's less a matter of coming at it after the situation occurs and bringing about some enforcement action. It sounds like what your primary goal is to give people the ability to avoid stepping over any ethical lines here. And that's I can imagine that is got to be equally, if not more important, really, in terms of maintaining an overall climate of solid ethics in state government. So one of the things that I understand is going on right now is that you actually are soliciting public input on what the ethics code should look like. And I also want to be clear kind of what stage you're at in the development of all this. I noticed in the press release that you put out this week, there was a remark that we're not really talking about enforcement yet. First, what we want to do is establish what a good ethics code looks like. And then when that gets established, then we can turn our attention to what should happen with violations or whatever. But one thing at a time, I guess. So talk to me a little bit about that. What are the how can members of the public kind of weigh in here and read what's been drafted and make comments and et cetera?
Well, if people go to our website, just Google Vermont Ethics Commission, they'll come up to our website, and right on the front page is a link to everything that we're discussing in terms of adopting a statutory ethics code. What we're hoping to get from the public, and I've made, I think, significant efforts to try and get the word to everybody within state government, is an agreement and understanding on just what kind of ethics standards should apply to people in state government. What should we, and I include myself in that group, be expected to do? What kind of, how will our conduct be judged, and what guidelines can we have? So I think with the ethics code, I really want to focus on it being more of a tool of assistance and guidance rather than, a trap for the unwary. And so when we talk about the need right now to concentrate on the code rather than enforcement, what we're talking about is we really want to reach agreement on what conduct is acceptable and have some clear lines so that people can guide their own conduct. And we want to, or we believe that the best way to enforce that is through understanding of what the requirements are, through education and awareness. And in our code, one of the things that we put in it is a section on education that would require everybody in state government, when you come to work for the state, to take a brief ethics overview course. And it could be online, it could be in person, there are any number of people could provide it. But to raise awareness when people begin their employment that there are standards that apply to all of us and we should be aware of them. And the standards, are not that complicated. Basically, what it boils down to is putting the interest of the state of Vermont and Vermonters ahead of our own individual interests. So we talk about, the need to avoid conflicts of interest and even the appearance of conflicts. We talk about not giving preferential treatment to people. You don't treat your friends better than people who aren't your friends. You don't mistreat people you don't like. Everybody who deals with the state of Vermont should be entitled to be treated the same way. You shouldn't use your position in state government for your own personal gain. Don't use your office to make money. Don't, call somebody and say, hey, I'm so-and-so in state government, can you give me tickets to, whatever event that you might be going to? Mm-hmm. Just reminders of people that, you shouldn't be using the office copy machine to copy your holiday cards that you're sending out to people. And we have a section on gifts, when it is or is not appropriate to receive a gift. There are problems with government officials, government employees taking gifts because of the perception that somebody's giving a gift because they're looking for something in exchange. And that appearance is, when that happens, is so harmful to people in government. If ever in our history there was a time of mistrust of government, I think this is it. And anything we can do to clarify what conduct we as state people, as public servants, are going to engage in and what is and is not appropriate, I think assures the public that we're working on the public's behalf and not our own individual interests. So that's sort of where we're going with this code. And what we're asking for and asking for public comment is for people to weigh in and say, in this draft that we have we missed something? Have we gone too far? Have we included things that maybe we don't need to include? When we drafted this at the very top of it in the introduction, you know, we said we understand that not everything in here is necessarily going to be found to be necessary or appropriate. But we're putting this out there to start the discussion, to get things going. And then once we've gotten all the comment by the end of August, then we'll distill the comment. We'll make a summary of all the comments we've received, and then we'll send our finalized draft over to the legislature in November. When we send the draft, we'll send our summary, and they'll know what we've heard and what arguments were made, you know, for or against certain provisions or for inclusion of things that aren't in there, and why we decided to either include them or not include them. And then ultimately, the legislature will make the final decision on what they want this code to look like.
You know, the temptations are really out there, I must say. I mean, I remember an interesting story about a senior state official in New York State. This was after Tropical or Superstorm Sandy, I think they ended up calling it, where a whole bunch of people had fallen trees, including like across driveways, blocking their cars in and so on. And sure enough, that was the case with this guy. And a public works crew showed up at his house and cleared away the fallen trees in his driveway so he could come to and, you know, to and from his house and get his car out, et cetera. That's the kind of thing that you look at that and you go, first off, sir, were you really stupid enough to think that some neighbor wasn't going to notice that yours was the only driveway on the street getting cleared by the public works crew, and that the neighbor might not call somebody? And long story short, he ended up losing his job as a senior state official. I don't remember which agency he was heading up, but it was at that level. But you know, you can sort of understand human nature is I got to get my car out. My driveway is all blocked in by these fallen trees, and boy, I got a possible source of help here. I get it, you know, and I think most people do. But on the other hand, I guess you're supposed to resist temptations like that, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I, when I started working here, I set up one of these Google alerts. So that every day I get a summary of news of ethics commissions. And mm-hmm. It's astounding, all the different ways people find to mess up and do things that are really just, at best yeah. ill-advised and at worst criminal. Mm-hmm. I think what an ethics code does, though, it's just a reminder. It's out there. And if we have continuing ethics education, you know, just people will have in the back of their mind, wait a minute. There are limits to what I can and cannot and should not do. And, you know, I think our biggest goal is to raise ethics awareness so people will think before they act and not automatically say, I'm going to call X, Y, and Z and see what I can get. They're going to go, is it appropriate for me to call? And then they'll go, probably not. And yep. If the public is convinced that we're behaving that way, then I think obviously that's a good thing. You know, we talk about, encouraging people to work in government and to participate in government. And I think from the, I don't want to say lowest level, from the local level up through state government, it's hard to attract people. I think when there is a feeling of distrust of government, there are good people who say, I'm not going to bother. So I think if we can raise ethics awareness through education and through conversation, then I think ultimately it encourages more people to want to get involved in government because they see it as really striving to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, one of the things that people say about government is that in many cases, a senior job in government will not pay as well as a senior job in the private sector, in a, say, in a corporation or something, or in a law firm, certainly. And so you sort of look at that, and I can imagine that some people might think that the ability to call people and get stuff done from inside a government office or whatever might be one of the attractions to get people in the government, but you're really not supposed to do that, and so that can't be on the list of job benefits, I guess. Is that a good way to look at it, or?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's not about getting a government position to better your own life. It's about mm-hmm. getting a government position where you can contribute to the general well-being.
Yeah. And
it's the people of Vermont first.
Right, yep. And when it's interesting to me also that if you look at even within Vermont state government, The judicial branch actually has had pretty strong ethics codes for quite some time. There's a code of ethics for it. I don't remember the exact name of it, but it's basically geared toward judges. And being a judge in Vermont, and I imagine in many other states, is kind of a tough life because of all the sort of personal connections you can't have. You know, you're not supposed to make political contributions, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff that sort of almost makes it somewhat of a hermit-like existence, because you're trying to really keep an arm's length relationship with really anybody and everybody, because anybody and everybody could end up in your courtroom. And there's also an ethics code, pretty well-developed ethics code for lawyers in Vermont who face a whole bunch of different temptations about the handling of client money and so on and so forth. All those things quite advanced compared to, what's been on the books historically for the executive and legislative branches. Do I have that roughly right?
I think that's correct. I think the judicial code for judges and the code of professional regulation is the. I'm sorry, I'm getting this wrong now.
Professional responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Are very complete, but they don't really answer the questions that most public servants face. You know, it's one mm-hmm. thing to talk about conflicts between clients or between you and your client. But, you know, the kind of complaints that we get in this office, you know, talk about, showing preferential treatment and things like that, which are very different. And, you know, there are in Vermont a couple of places that set standards for conduct of state officials and state employees. The governor has an executive order from 2017, which is, you know, pretty comprehensive, telling people what the expectations are. But again, that's mm-hmm. it's an order, and it doesn't really have the force of law, and it doesn't apply to people that, you know, beyond those whom the governor appoints to positions. So there is that. And in the Department of Human Resources, there are some provisions in their manuals, which is really a compendium of various documents that talk about what the expectations are. But there's nothing that really applies to everybody that is clear and has the force of law. And I should point out that back in February, the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, treasurer, and auditor of accounts all authored or co-authored a letter that was sent to the chairs of the House Government Operations and the Senate Government Operations panel supporting adoption of a statutory code of ethics. So this is a either bipartisan or it really should be a nonpartisan issue. You know, that ethics oversight, ethics reform, having ethics standards is not a political question. It's something that everyone, I hope, will be able to agree on.
Yeah, because certainly ethical questions and problems, et cetera, are not unique to one party. That's also clear. You know, the need for an ethics code
is
multipartisan.
And those of us who serve in state you know, in state government don't serve, or most people don't serve as Democrats or Republicans. They're appointed or they're hired to fill a position. But once they're there, they are supposed to act in the best interest of the people of Vermont. And a code that helps them do that will be a great help for everyone.
Okay, one last time on the website, you know, how do people participate here? Because we are running out of time here. Larry Novins, where should people go if they want to look at the code, the draft code, and make comments?
Go to the Vermont Ethics Commission website and just, you know, Google Vermont Ethics Commission. You'll get there. And on the front page, there is a blurb, I guess it says Ethics Commission to submit draft code of ethics to legislature. Please help. And you click.
You have
on
an upcoming public hearing too, right? Virtual public hearing.
Yeah. Yeah. We're taking comments, written comments now, and we'll have a public hearing in August, I think on the 12th of August. And we'll send out more information about how people can participate in that when we get closer. But we really, really want all the input we can get.
Larry Novins, the director of the State Ethics Commission, thank you very much for being my guest on the Dave Graham Show this morning. Good talking with you.
Thank you, Dave. Good talking to you.
Going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple of words from our sponsors, and we will be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program on this Friday morning, July the 10th, 2020. And my next guest is Linda Joy Sullivan. She is a Democratic state representative from Dorset, and she is running for state auditor of accounts this year, and we're going to be speaking with her, and I hope maybe taking some listener calls if you have some questions you'd like to ask this candidate for Vermont State Auditor. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury, the toll-free number 1-877-291-8255. And Linda Joy Sullivan, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for letting me be on your show. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
Sure. I'm trying to go through the list of candidates for statewide office, actually, and slowly making my way down the list and letting folks just sort of introduce themselves to Vermonters. A lot of folks around the state obviously wouldn't be that familiar, really, with a first-time candidate for statewide office, even though you have been in the legislature now. I wanted to talk with you also just about your reasons for running and what you would hope to accomplish as auditor. So let's start with that pretty basic question. Why are you running?
Okay, so that's a great question. I have actually served 2 terms as representative in my southern Vermont towns. And then, like any auditor, I decided it was actually time to take stock and examine my situation and figure out where I could best serve Vermonters. So when I looked at my skill set, I thought, where could they be used to bring the most value? The job of state auditor was a logical option for me to consider. I am an auditor, a licensed CPA. I have been a peer reviewer of other auditors and their firms. I'm a turnaround specialist, an expert witness, and forensic auditing expert. I've been a court-appointed receiver, bankruptcy trustee, and I've taught auditing at the university level. So I usually get appointed to fix things. And the more I look into the statutory role of the auditor in Vermont, the more clear it became that the Vermont auditor is a great fit for me. And even more importantly, that is where I truly believe I could be of the greatest value to Vermonters. My background and skill set would provide the leadership needed to the excellent team that's in the state auditor's office, ensuring efficiency and accountability at every level of government, and minimizing turnover within the office. So that pretty much was the process where I began. But if you'll let me, I'd like to dive a bit deeper into my decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
So is that right? So from my 4 years in the Vermont legislature, I have learned that most people in the General Assembly are really trying to do the right thing. But politics often gets in the way. And in fact, I found that...
I'm sorry, but what gets in the way?
Politics.
Okay.
And so I have found that almost all people I have gotten to know throughout our government work hard and they try to serve the people. But even with great people and a great system of government, things don't always work out the way they should. And government is not the best at self-criticism or keeping itself tuned up and running efficiently. So that's why the auditor position was so attractive to me. Because my training and experience is focused on identifying, understanding, and fixing problems. And when problems actually go beyond waste and inefficiency and enter the realm of fraud and abuse, setting those situations right is also right up my alley. So deep down, my guiding principles are all about solving problems and making things right. And in my public service, that translates to delivering good government. And good government is a very big key to helping Vermont families be more prosperous and helping to grow the Vermont economy in a way that doesn't endanger this beautiful state that we all love. I would also approach the job differently from our current progressive incumbent. Because I am a professional auditor, I am comfortable that I can hit the ground running in this job. I will be leading a team of professionals with a similar background to mine. It helps when you speak the same language and have a common understanding of the job that needs to be done. I'm very comfortable with leadership. Many of the people I've worked with in government are confident in my leadership skills. They've chosen me to represent them in several national and regional organizations. From employment surveys that were undertaken by the Department of Human Services, I know there was a bit of an issue in the auditor's office with people actually understanding their career path, and I would focus on that. Another focus would be ensuring that everyone in the state auditor's office actually understands the goals of the office. And I believe that my goal for the office would be somewhat different than the current auditor. And I do thank him for his service, but I believe that Montpelier does need fresh eyes. I believe that the state auditor's office can be more proactive than it is now, and that the office can actually do a better job of identifying major potential issues and working to help various parties in government to head those off before they become bigger problems. A couple of examples of that would be the state college system, our unfunded pension and retiree health care position. The state college's financial issues have been pretty clear for a number of years, but COVID-19 caused the slow-moving problem to hit hard and fast. The unfunded liability problem has really been growing since the 1990s, and has become one of the largest financial holes in state finances. These are two examples of big problems where I think the state auditor's voice could be a help in creating urgency and action. It is important, though, to remember that the state auditor has a lot of discretion to choose what to work on. But at the same time, the state auditor does not have the power to force others in government to act. So the current auditor has noted with some frequency that others in government often don't follow his recommendations and suggestions, and I would hope to do better in that area. And one way that I believe I could do better is by using working relationships that I have developed across the agencies and departments and building new ones where I don't already have them, and using those relationships, I would expect that I could change what I now perceive to be a reaction of cringing when told the state auditor's office is coming to their area. In cases where there's wrongdoing, I would want them to cringe. But in most cases, the state auditor's office can help people who want to do their jobs well and to do them better. I believe a more constructive relationship with others in government can help to drive more change and acceptance of recommendations from the state auditor's office, particularly coming through a pandemic and going through the phases as we progress out of the pandemic. And another way I believe I could do better is by actually partnering with others in government to want to achieve these changes. The one lesson I have learned from being in the legislature is that it is important to understand how to get something done. Just as well, it is important to come up with a good idea, but you have to know how to get it done. And I think I have the skills in that area, and I would expect to build on these skills to much further myself as the Vermont auditor and help the state of Vermont. You know, it's really important that the auditor needs to ensure that the government respects the hard-earned money of the taxpayers and is not politically persuaded to choose audits that may be popular to one particular party. The popularity contest for electing our next Vermont State Auditor of Accounts should be driven by the candidate's direct licenses, credentials, and experience to the needs of the office, not policy and lobbying. In times like these, I believe Vermont needs a true public auditor. Much discretion is given to the audits chosen by the state auditor. I believe that these selections should not be driven by policy wants and vindicating any political agendas or what is dear to someone's heart. The audits chosen actually need to be those that are focused on the impact to Vermont's economy and ensuring that systems are in compliance. And they all need to be done with the experience of auditing with an independent, skeptical attitude and not just using buzzwords to give the appearance of independence. There are so many threats to a state auditor's independence. There's the threat of self-interest. The auditor must never have a financial or a policy agenda. There's the threat of advocacy. The auditor must never be driven by political or policy agenda and force an audit to drive that conclusion home and promote a policy position. There's the threat of familiarity. The auditor cannot be too familiar with or have long-standing relationships with former clients or political groups or lobbyists that want a specific policy result. And that's why I believe that the state auditor should never take organizational endorsements. The state auditor must remain neutral on issues of policy, in addition to strictly avoiding the embrace of partisan positions. These endorsements and organizational vetting processes have appearances that need to be avoided by the state auditor. The state auditor must be far more than a numbers person. They must be a professional auditor who can fix things and guide with real leadership and people skills.
Linda, let me stop you for a moment and just ask you. It seems as though there are some areas in which auditing and policy development could rub up against one another pretty directly. And one I'm thinking of is something that has been addressed by more than one auditor, maybe three or so in my recollection right now. I'd have to look up maybe a bunch of news stories to really nail that down, and this is the Vermont Economic Progress Council's use of state funds to help promote business growth, in which they basically give grants to businesses and on the promise that the business will develop jobs, will add jobs to the state economy. And one of the questions that has been raised repeatedly by auditors is what's called the but-for test. So, in other words, the if you're spending state money wisely, I think most people would agree that you don't want to just throw money to businesses who are going to do this hiring anyway, even without state money. You want to direct it in places where it really makes the difference and convinces the business that, you know, this is the factor that tips the equation toward this expansion that they may be contemplating. So this has been addressed by more than one auditor, but it seems as though if you decided that after looking at it as an auditor, you didn't really like the but-for test. You thought that was just a poor piece of policy. Wouldn't that be a case of essentially influencing the policy by pointing out that that it has some flaws?
So, yes, and I think that the incumbent always talks of the but-for. But, you know, the but-for test is really a test that's commonly used in both tort law and criminal law and is used to determine actual causation. So the key here would be, why are you looking at the but-for? In order to get the grants, they've already gone through that stage. Now look at the revenues and see what they're producing. Look at the performance of what is going on. The but-for is over. You got there. So why not focus on the actual well-being of the program? Is it meeting what it is supposed to do, and is it bringing a benefit to Vermont?
So you don't think there ought to be any ability to tap the brakes earlier in the process before the grant is awarded, it sounds like.
I do. I think you can do it in a proactive way. I think you know that these programs are out there. Go in and speak to these people, help monitor and see what's going on, and look at the revenue generation, and begin by performance audits or memorandums, and go out there and work with the parties and tell them they need to be in compliance and help them catch what's going on so they can put in compliance positions and move forward to make these projects work.
In the last couple of weeks, it seems like you have taken aim at the incumbent auditor, Doug Hoffer, on the subject of recently announced audit he did of first stage of an audit, long-term audit, I guess he's doing of the OneCare Affordable Accountable Care Organization. I keep calling it affordable. It's accountable care organization. This effort to come up with an all-payer system for Vermont's healthcare providers. And Doug Hoffer has expressed a degree of skepticism about this, but your critique seemed to go less to whether it's proper for an auditor to express skepticism about this piece of healthcare policy, and more to just thinking that he had issued this as a matter of, it's almost like a publicity stunt to try to generate interest in his campaign. Do I have that right? I mean, was that the core of your criticism that you issued recently?
So I think you're confusing two things. I think first, the some descriptive audit, that the incumbent called the descriptive audit, was released and then immediately was sent out on an email blast to Vermonters as his part of his campaign platform. So as an auditor, there is no such thing as a descriptive audit. So that we should be very clear on. My question also is, this audit on the website appears to have been looked at and finished in October 2019. What I questioned was, why would you have to hire a political activist to write an analysis so that you could blast it out to your campaign constituents so that they could see this, when you have qualified people inside your office and you're a policy analyst? Surely you can write it, or your deputy could write it. Why are you doing this now? So I definitely think somebody should analyze the skepticism. But I'm looking to see the audit report. All I got was a work paper that an auditor would use when they're first starting an audit of what is the description of the entity. Well, to me, you know, auditing is a long-established profession, and those actually trained understand the rules and procedures that define how an audit should be conducted. So while I think it was good that people understood the description, this was more like a position paper explaining the way the ACO worked or would support an argument. And to me, there were only two recommendations made, and there weren't any sort of specific recommendations, but were more questions as to whether the whole Obamacare measurement structure designed for ACOs by the feds, who were funding the bulk of the experiment, were adequate or not. I mean, we know this is an experiment. So it seems to be a worthwhile multi-year experiment, but logically, it made some sense, you know, to improve the system. We know that. These questions have been asked for years.
We do have a listener calling in, I believe, Michael from Bennington. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning, Linda Joy. I'm just calling in to be a little bit picky, as you both were discussing the VEGIE, the Vermont Economic Growth Incentive, before. Dave, you used the term grant to describe it. A grant is something that you get when you apply for it, and it's cash that you get. The very nature of the incentive is that an employer who applies for the incentive, the right to have an incentive, has to perform on that incentive. Let's say I run, I don't know, Rinky Dink Corporation. I come into Vermont. I make an application, for example, to the Vermont Economic Progress Council. I say I'm going to hire X number of new employees at a specific salary level above minimum wage. When I have done that, and I have verified that with VEPSE, and when the tax department of the state has verified that, and those jobs have remained true jobs for X number of time, then I have the right to get the incentive. It's an incentive that you work for. It's not a grant. It's like, let's say, you hire me at $50,000 a year, and you say, Michael, you're going to get $50,000 a year. Here are the things I expect you to do. But if you do these extra things, here is the incentive I will give you. If you increase your productivity by 40%, measurable by these particular objectives, I will give you a performance bonus of $10,000. Only when I perform do I get the incentive. And that's the exact same thing that's in the embedded in VEGIE. Only when an employer performs what the employer's workplace has committed to do and keeps that performance going for several years, does the incentive get paid in a certain amount? Just wanted to correct that impression.
Okay, so incentive is, and you're just
incentive,
you're making a distinction between
isn't it grant?
Incentive between
grants
the grant.
And incentives
yeah.
are very different.
Okay.
Thanks, Matt.
I guess it still doesn't get to the but-for question, which is that would the company, how likely would the company have been to hire these new workers at the salaries it's paying now without the incentive? In other words,
Those are two different questions. Those are two different questions. If you want to encourage employers to hire people, and the employer goes through the process and the trouble of putting the program together and reporting to VEPSE and reporting to the state tax department, well, the employer is going through hoops to do this.
Yeah.
The incentive and the but-for are two very different questions. And I guess I would answer the but-for part, because I very often hear, well, employers are going to do this anyway. Employers are going to come to Vermont anyway. Workers are going to come to Vermont anyway. Our census and our business universe in Vermont doesn't show that.
Michael, I'm sorry to do this, but we actually have to go call it on this segment, because we got to go to some top of the hour news here. Thanks for the call. And Linda Joy Sullivan, thank you very much for being my guest on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEB, FM, and AM. Good talking with you, and try to enjoy this virtual campaign trailer or whatever. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
We're opening up stairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back. It's, let's see, July the 10th, 2020, Friday morning. And on Fridays these days, we're talking to Bob Ney after the mid-show break. Bob is a national correspondent. He was with Talk Media News for a number of years. And lately, I think he's been sort of freelancing as one of the national experts. He talks to a number of radio stations around the country. And we are lucky enough to have ours be one of them on Friday mornings. And he is someone who is very thoughtful and insightful about what is going on in the bigger national scene out there. I expect Bob will be joining us any moment now. There are always lots of stories out there to delve into with Bob, and we're hoping that he will be weighing in very shortly. Let's see here, Bob. This morning, he sends out a little note here to talk about what his programs are talking about, or what his top stories are, basically. And this is the his lead story, as you wouldn't be surprised to hear, is about the coronavirus. And Bob Ney is talking about, actually, other countries are considering what some U.S. states are considering, which is sort of to lock back down. I guess the United States is not alone in a resurgence of and growth of this coronavirus in terms of the numbers of people testing positive, getting sick, etc. Well, here's what Bob says. He says, well, some countries have thus far managed to keep cases under control after opening up. Dozens of countries that had initially turned a corner are now seeing a worrying rebound. They have to decide if and how to return to lockdown and whether their populations will stand for it. There are actually protesters going on in Belgrade, Serbia, the former Yugoslavia, people angry that the government is talking about is trying to lock back down after some reopening. I believe Bob Ney is actually with us right now. And Bob, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am doing good, except it is very, very hot.
You're out in Ohio, I gather?
Yes, I sure am.
Yeah, it's hot and sticky here, too. It's really kind of getting, you know, two or three days of this, and for a Vermonter, it starts to get old. It's sort of like, come on, you know, I don't want this one.
Right.
I spent a summer, in, or actually a year, I should say, in Columbus, Ohio, back in the mid-90s, and I remember there were times in the summer out there when it was just, whew, sweaty. And that's what this weather we've been having this week kind of feels like that. But anyway, so tell me, I was talking about your lead story, which has to do with the coronavirus. It appears to be kind of gaining new ground or whatever in countries, not just the U.S., but elsewhere also. And talk to us a little bit about that.
Right. You know, Serbia initially really didn't catch the outbreak like any of the rest of the countries did. It had a strict lockdown in early May, and it lifted it and allowed crowds to go back into sporting events and bars and, you know, et cetera, normal life. And now, of course, they're talking about a curfew, and people are upset about that. And now critics, though, of the president of Serbia have said, well, you opened up too fast anyway. And then others are saying we don't need to go back to lockdowns. So it's going to be lockdown again or not, or what do you do with the venues, the sports events, you know, et cetera. And then Japan seen its case count, and it's ticked upwards in recent weeks, you know, so they're, again, trying to plan on what to do, and also about can the fans come back into the stadiums. I mean, it seems like overseas everything's about sports, you know. Mm-hmm. Then Melbourne, Australia was quick. It entered 6 weeks of a lockdown after a record high of 191 infections were recorded in the state of Victoria on Tuesday. They locked it down immediately. And they said that really that's kind of a sacrifice. The second largest city is locking down, so nobody else really hopefully has to. So each country deals. Israel is considering neighborhood level restrictions. So you might have one part of the neighborhood okay and the other part locked down.
Wow. Wow.
Everybody's different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose
you got the United States, 50 different things.
Well, that actually interests me because the president and the education secretary, Betsy DeVos, earlier this week were saying they want schools all over the country to reopen in the fall. And the thought occurred to me that Vermont is actually in a pretty good place right now relative to a lot of other places in managing the coronavirus and keeping our numbers low and so on. And the governor's talked about opening up schools, and in fact, that's the plan, as students return at the end of the summer. The Arizona, on the other hand, I have some loved ones who are teachers out there, and I can imagine easily Arizona saying we can't reopen our schools because of our numbers. They've had some of the highest numbers in the world in recent weeks, and so why would you impose the same policy on all 50 states here?
Well, I really don't think we can anymore, you know, or try to. I mean, even within our states, it's different. We have five counties in trouble in Ohio. The rest of them aren't necessarily in trouble. School systems, mm-hmm. Newark, Ohio, it's 5 days a week. Where my grandchildren go in Belmont County, Ohio, they're talking about 2 days a week. Some are talking about online learning only. So it's not even just different state by state. It's different county by county, you know, in America.
Yeah, and so when the president comes out and the education secretary come out and they say we want schools open 100% everywhere, is that for real or what is that?
Well, I think it is because, look, here they know, and these are horrible decisions. Just to give you a scenario, if it's 2 days a week, somebody tell mm-hmm. me how on earth a family – is somebody going to quit their job? What do you do with the kids? How would you afford daycare? Would there be daycare? How are the kids really going to learn? Are families going to really tutor their children? I mean, it's no matter which way you turn, it's chaos. And if the kids only go 2 days a week, wow, the repercussions of that are going to be astronomical.
And is the theory here that the two-day-a-week thing is that basically you bring in the first half of the alphabet on Mondays and Tuesdays and the second half of the alphabet on Thursdays and Fridays or something like that? Or how would that actually work?
Well, I think that's how they do it. I mean, and I've heard people say, teachers have told me, what, does the virus leave you alone if you're only there 2 days? I mean, there's all kinds of theories to this. What I would predict is people are going to become so angry, they're going to vote down levies, they're going to be angry at teachers, they're going to be angry at administrators, they're going to be angry. Because if you are sitting in your house and you or your spouse have to quit your job to take care of the kids and then you're going to lose your house, this is going to be a very, very unhappy country for the most part, I think. Most people cannot do that. Now, if one of the spouses is not working, that's, you know, a different world.
Yeah.
And so I think they're just saying that, hoping to get on the side of what, you know, the majority of people think about going back to school. It's a real dilemma. You can't win on this one.
So the United States is sanctioning Chinese officials over the Uyghur, am I pronouncing that right, human rights abuses?
Yes, Uyghur. Yes, this is interesting. I mean, we are on a China sanction kick like we haven't been for ages. I mean, this issue has been around. The Uyghur Muslims are ethnic minorities in a province called Xinjiang, and they've been persecuted for years, rounded up, put into camps, et cetera. And now we are saying, okay, we're going to sanction you over it. It's very interesting. I mean, I look at this even beyond the issue. You know, we were sanctioning them on Tibet last week. So I think that it's just, you know, we're after full pressure on China, and whatever issue comes up, we kind of go with it.
And what is the U.S. goal in doing this? I mean, I understand that you know, on the one hand, maybe the surface, the announcement, the press release would say the U.S. goal is to get them to lighten up on their human rights abuses regarding the Uyghurs, and the Tibetans, but I mean, the fact that all these things are coming out now and to address problems that, as you just said, have existed for years, there must be some overarching strategy here. Do you know what it is?
Well, I think, look, these days, when you talk about the Chinese government, you know, if they look the wrong way, go, you know, go beat them up. That's okay. Sanction them. So I think it's a popular thing to do. Sanction them on the religious rights. We're sanctioning them on the Tibetans. We're sanctioning them on human rights. I think China, especially after the virus, is an easy, easy target. So I think these are probably politically popular things to do, to be frank with you, number one. Number two, it gives Trump an edge. I think dealing with China, which I did in Congress with Bernie Sanders, Bernie and I were on the same side of the trade issues, and the only thing China understood was aggression by us. If you were nice to them, they would step on you twice, smile, and say thank you. And so I think this is part of the strategy, too, of being very aggressive with China until they start to yield maybe on trade issues.
So the trade issues are the big prize here, I gather.
I think so.
Are you hearing much concern from, you know, folks on the Hill, for instance, about any effect on the climate within the United States for say Asian Americans who have been raising a lot of alarm about increased basically hate crimes against them, especially as the coronavirus crisis has unfolded?
I really don't hear anything now. In the beginning, I did. In the beginning, people were very worried. I think, you know, there's always crazy people out there, but I think that the most part, people separate Chinese Americans from the Chinese government. But in the beginning, there was a lot of talk and concern, absolutely, in the beginning. Now it seems to have died down on that issue.
Wow. It's kind of part of this overall climate of people being more easily going to anger and distrust and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. Missing Seoul mayor's body found after massive search. And what's going on with that? I mean, how did this person die? And what are people saying about it?
We don't know. He was missing. Mayor Park Won Soon's body was discovered. His family, his daughters, said his phone was shut off in a certain area and was then, you know, not communicating with them. And it looks like, I mean, I'm going to venture to say he is most likely killed himself. He was the subject of sexual harassment charges that were coming out. And all of a sudden he takes his phone, he goes to a remote wooded area, he vanishes, and then he's found dead. So I would say, if I had to guess, that probably this was most likely a suicide.
But it'll be his daughter called police on Thursday afternoon and said her father had given her a, quote, will-like verbal message before leaving their home hours earlier. Well, maybe he had a sense that I'm going out to die right now, and so here's my last words or something.
That's what I think. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, U.S. default coronavirus strategy, herd immunity. Didn't Sweden try this?
Yeah, they tried it. Kind of worked, kind of didn't. Their economic gain wasn't as much. But a lot of people are now talking about the fact that at some point in time, if there's no vaccination, then there's going to be herd immunity where you separate the older, the sick people from the younger, healthier ones while the virus burns through the young, healthier ones who live and survive, and then it goes dormant. And, you know, this is an ugly solution, but it's something people have talked about.
Yeah, that is yikes. Well, more to come, I'm sure. Let's visit again next week and figure out where we are
Thank you very much, Bob Ney. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. My next guest is with the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. She's a vice president there, and her name is Marilyn Cargill. And she's going to talk to us about some developments in the world of student loans and grants, et cetera. And sounds like the climate there might be getting a little better for students who are looking for some assistance in furthering their educations. Let's find out all about it from Marilyn Cargill. Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Dave. It's great to be on.
So tell me a little bit about what these phenomena you are seeing in relation to student loans and grants and in this in sounds like there may be some effect here from the coronavirus situation.
Absolutely. So every year, as most people know, students have to apply for financial aid, and they fill out their free application for federal student aid, which is better known as a FAFSA, and they fill out a Vermont grant application, and that begins the process for them to be considered for state aid, their institution's aid, and then the aid from the federal government. This year, in recognition that a lot of Vermont families have been hit pretty hard by this COVID virus, and it might be that they were unemployed or they might have lost hours, they might have had changes in new expenses that they haven't had before because of this virus, the legislature gave BSAC some additional funds so that we would be able to help Vermont families still be able to be in school this fall, even if they were facing those unusual expenses. And so we've been working directly with families to say, if anything is going on in your family this year that would prevent you from being able to go to school, if the information that you originally filed on that FAFSA has changed because the world has now changed, you can appeal and we can consider you for some of this additional funding that we've received. And so far, about 400 families have written in and asked for that opportunity to be reconsidered. So it actually is, in a really odd kind of way, a really good time to be trying to go to school because there is this additional money to help families successfully get their students into school this fall.
That's interesting. You know, these occasionally things pop up that are sort of these weird silver linings or something from this coronavirus outbreak and the response to it and so on. And so in this case, now my recollection is our kids are both past college age, and my recollection is that we were filling out FAFSA forms and so on in like January, and that would determine the aid that a student would get for the following September. Do I have that roughly right?
So it's actually changed a little bit since your students did this, but your timing is right. Students can start filling out their FAFSA in October of the year before they plan to start school. And what they're actually filling it out with is income information from 2 years ago. So they're trying to go to school in the fall of 20 for the most part, and they're using their family's 2018 income. Well, for an awful lot of Vermonters, what happened in 2018 is not indicative at all of what's happening right now. And that's why this appeal process is so incredibly important.
I gather in normal times there may also be changes, but I guess you just sort of live with that because, you know, in normal times, oftentimes people's incomes go up a little bit. If somebody has wage earner in the house has a new union contract or something.
That's exactly right. Normally, you would have expected that incomes might have increased slightly in a two-year period. So looking back 2 years is to the family's benefit. And also, by going back 2 years, I'm sure you can remember when you were filing these, scrambling to get your taxes done so you could file your children's financial aid applications. And now, because they go back 2 years, you don't have that scramble. Your tax returns are probably long since filed before you need that information. But the problem is, in a year like this, when the world turns a little bit upside down, and a lot of families, at one point over 15% of Vermont was filing unemployment compensation requests. When that has occurred, then those incomes from 2 years ago are really not helpful to families. And so what we did is we've taken the funds, and these are COVID relief funds. These are CRF funds that the legislature appropriated to DSAC purposely to address this issue because the legislature is very concerned that Vermont families are not going to feel like they have the resources this year for their students to continue their education. And, of course, for those individual students and for the economic health of the state of Vermont, where we need a workforce, you know, continually being trained, and we know that the majority of jobs in Vermont require some training beyond high school. It doesn't have to be a 2 or 4 year college degree, but there's some type of training or education beyond high school that's needed for most of our high pay jobs. The legislature really wanted to ensure that families would have the resources they need. And so what families do right now is if they, for example, have lost income, they can come to DSAC and they can fill out an estimated income worksheet, which again just says to them, tell us what your income is in 20. Don't worry about what it was back in 2018. Tell us what it is in 2020, and we'll reevaluate your eligibility. But in addition to DSAC looking at this, students can also, and their families can also go right to their colleges. Colleges are doing similar work as well. So you can also go right to your school with the same information that you've provided to DSAC to see if the school can also make an adjustment.
And are colleges stepping up and able to do that? And the reason I ask is because many colleges are kind of reeling with, certainly the Vermont State Colleges in recent times have been reeling with the effects of the COVID-19 and, of course, with, in their case, longer-term problems. But so are colleges actually able to do this?
It depends on the institution. Some colleges do have the ability to help with appeals and are helping. But the other thing, remember when you filled out that FAFSA, you were applying for federal aid, state aid, and institution aid. So even if your institution can't change, they will look to see if it makes that student eligible for additional Pell Grant money or if it makes that student eligible for different loan options. So still worth doing it with your school just to, so that you're maximizing the eligibility that you have. But you're not wrong. Schools are reeling from what's going on financially right now.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about that after we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break and for some CBS News in just a couple of minutes here. And I wanted to delve into that a little bit more. But in the meanwhile, are any schools saying to families who are successful in getting additional Pell Grants or getting additional loans or getting additional aid from either the state or federal governments, hey, we're now going to adjust our grant, the institutional grant, downward because we're in tough financial straits here. We need to save some money. Any of the colleges taking that approach?
Not that we've talked to, and we've talked to a lot of our Vermont schools over this particular issue. That's one of the reasons you need to go to your school because what they're doing, they're not changing their cost of their school. What they're changing is what the family can afford to pay. If they can lower that amount, even if they can't fill the gap, if those funds that you got from DSAC or the funds that you get from Pell can fill the gap, then that family still is not what schools would consider overfunded because the family contribution has already decreased. So
yeah, I get. Okay.
Does that make sense to you? As you know,
yeah, I get what you're saying.
Process.
The picture has changed for the family, and so even if it has changed for the college, then you kind of have to go along. We are going to take a brief break here for some bottom-of-the-hour news from CBS. We're going to hear a couple words from our sponsors. And on the other side, Marilyn Cargill will be continuing to be my guest here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we'll talk more about higher ed financing in just a few minutes, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. I wanted to make one brief announcement, which is that just after the close of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM, we wrap up at 11 o'clock. It's going to be a news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials talking about the state response to the COVID-19 crisis, the latest details on what's open, what's closed, what's coming, and et cetera. The governor and these top state officials have been very open and transparent about what they see as needing to happen in Vermont to try to keep the COVID-19 virus at bay to the extent we can here. And Vermont has been relatively, I guess, successful in that regard compared to other states. And so may it continue to be so. And the governor will be talking about the latest efforts just after the 11 o'clock news from CBS on WDEV, FM, and AM. We'll go to live special coverage of that event. And so don't touch that dial, as we used to say. So, all righty. Well, let's get back to Marilyn Cargill, a vice president with the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. And she's talking to us about some a little more generosity out there, I guess, maybe the overall headline here on what's going on with student aid, with grants and loans, et cetera, for people who are trying to pursue a higher education. And Marilyn, I did want to check back in with you about the not just the state of college financing, but the overall state of higher ed right now, because much like the rest of education, much like the rest of the world, actually, the entire system is in upheaval related to this COVID-19 crisis. There's, I think I saw one major university announcing just in recent days that it was planning on going all online for the fall semester. Other schools are talking about some kind of a hybrid system. And obviously this has big financial implications for the schools, because now all of a sudden students won't be on meal plans. They won't be staying in the dorms, but mortgage payments still have to be made on the dorms. So there's just a ton of financial considerations and so on for higher ed. Are these schools going to survive and continue to be viable educational institutions into the future?
You know, Dave, I think that's a really fair question. I don't know that I am the best person to try and answer it, but I will tell you that I've been meeting with schools across Vermont for the last couple of weeks talking about their plans for the fall. These schools are working on Plan A and Plan B. So they're all trying very hard to get their students back on campus, at least in some form. I think they're really committed to students having as normal an experience as any of us can have in the times that we're currently living in. Clearly, they're talking that their students will social distance and their students will be wearing masks. So all of the things that we all need to do to keep safe, they're talking about. But they're working very hard and heads down trying to get this right and be able to bring those students back on campus. At the same time, I'm also hearing them talk about contingency planning, that perhaps you're on campus, but you may not be in your classroom for every one of your classes. You may take some of your classes remotely from your dorm room. There may be students that end up going home before Thanksgiving, as we normally see them do, and not coming back for the rest of the semester, but doing the rest of their semester remotely. So schools are getting out to students with what their plans are. I think they're working really hard on this. And I have, I don't know if I have confidence, but I certainly have optimism that what Vermont schools are doing shows that same leadership and that same sound consideration of how to do this right that we're seeing across Vermont in the way that COVID virus is being handled here and our response to it in comparison to perhaps some other states. So I don't see a lot of knee-jerk reactions. I see a lot of considered and informed approaches. I think the schools are also working collaboratively on this and supporting each other and sharing best practices and ideas. So, you know, I've been listening, as I think you have too, to the governor's press conference, and I heard the former president of Norwich, who's leading the group of colleges that are trying to get their plans together for this fall, speak. And they're putting a lot of effort and a lot of time into getting this right. So, you know, I don't know financially how this all plays out. I do know that, you know, and I think this is common knowledge, the state colleges and UVM have received some of the funding that VSAC is receiving to go directly to students. They're also receiving some of that funding to help out with the expenses that they have incurred because of this exact same situation. So, you know, I think the state and I think the schools are really digging in to figure this out. And I also think, you know, if you look at any of the maps that show hotspots in the United States and spots that really seem to be doing well with this virus, Vermont is really standing out. So it may make Vermont actually a really desirable place to go to school.
Hey, I wanted to mention that we do welcome listeners calling in, and our number is 244-1777. That's the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And my guest is Marilyn Cargill. She's vice president at the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. We're talking about higher ed financing and how things are being affected by the coronavirus and the response thereto, et cetera. We do have a listener calling in right now. I believe it's Pam from Duxbury. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you. Hello, Marilyn. So a lot of focus on trying to get the students into school this fall, right? It's the traditional college experience. I wonder, Marilyn, if you could speak a little bit to what VSAC is doing to help people who may be out of college and had, you know, the VSAC loans to help them through this crisis, and also what we used to call the non-degree grant, which is now Advance Vermont, right, which gives people some different options than just enrolling in a 2 or 4 year degree plan. So thank you.
Very good questions. Actually, that first one is really intriguing to me. There are, you know, probably thousands of Vermonters out there who are in their 20s and 30s and went to school a few years ago and are still paying off their student loans through VSAC. And any kind of loan forgiveness or that kind of thing that's been going on, given the economic dislocation from the COVID-19, Marilyn?
Sure. So first, Pam, thank you very much for that question. It was great. And yeah, the answer to that is yes, VSAC does have help that we have been offering to students and former students who are in exactly the situation that you're describing, Dave. So we have a program that allows borrowers who are facing economic hardship to be able to suspend the payments on those student loans. And we are setting them up in 3-month increments if that's what the borrower would like. So we started seeing these requests. This is a program VSAC has had for a number of years on our loans, but it's very seldom used. And, of course, it's being used at a much higher rate now than it was. So I would say before the virus hit, we had less than 1% of people who were choosing to put their loans in a forbearance, which is the tool that we have to help them. Right now, we're closer to 10% of students. Our borrowers asking to have their loans in forbearance. It's been as high as 12 or 13%, so it's actually going down ever so slightly. But we do have a program, so if borrowers are struggling to make payments because of the coronavirus,
they absolutely should call VSAC and ask us if there's something we can do. And we have the ability to put those loans in a suspended payment state for, as I said, 3 months at a time, and then we'll reevaluate with the borrower where they are at. So they should definitely call. And if your loan isn't with VSAC, so you have federal loans, you may have loans with other lenders besides VSAC, definitely call them. You definitely want to ask. What you don't ever want to do with a student loan is ignore it, because there are actually programs that can help. And if students and borrowers don't make those phone calls, once those loans become delinquent, they will be reported to credit bureaus, and then if you default, that has such lasting negative impact on your ability to have credit going forward. So you don't ever want to sit quiet and just hope it goes away, because, of course, it doesn't. And so making those phone calls, it's really a good chance that your student loan lender, whether it's VSAC or someone else, will have a program that can help you. So we encourage everyone to reach out and make those phone calls.
If you have loans that you're paying off and now all of a sudden find yourself basically unable to make payments on with other lenders aside from VSAC, is there any coming to VSAC and saying, I would like to refinance this with VSAC?
Unfortunately, VSAC does not have a refinance program. But what we would do, even if your loans aren't with VSAC, if you called VSAC and just said, you know, I don't even know who my loans are with, I'm in trouble, I can't make these payments, what we could do is we could, with your permission, do the research to figure out who holds your loans. And you may have more than one organization that holds those loans. We would help you make that phone call. We'd either coach you on how to make the phone call, or we would even engage in a three-way call with you to help talk to your lender about the situation you're in. You know, sometimes we all know this. Every industry has its own language, and sometimes mm-hmm. it helps if somebody is on the line with you who speaks the same language. I think personally, I find that when I'm dealing in medical issues, right? So I don't feel like I speak medical language very well, but I do speak financial aid. So, you know, that's something we would do. We would call with them to talk to a lender, or we would at least coach them through, this is what we believe are your options that you could be asking for, and make sure they feel informed enough to be able to make a good phone call.
Yeah, that's the ability to speak the language certainly is key. I'm lucky enough to be married to a nurse, so when it's a medical situation, I'd let her be the translator.
For
the medical
right?
stuff. We don't have a financial aid expert in the family, so we just got to pay him off, I guess.
Well, give VSAC a call if you need help with that. The other part of Pam's question was asking what we can do for people who perhaps are not looking at 2 and 4 year colleges, but may be looking at training programs. And there is actually a very large program in Vermont that's been around since the early 80s that helps students and adults especially who are interested in retraining. And it's called the Advancement Grant. And that is another program that students definitely, or potential students, and I guess students, should definitely be applying for. So Advancement Grants are really targeted to 2 different populations. They're targeted to adults who are looking to be trained in some field. It could be that they're changing their job. So they want to go from, I don't know, working in tourism to working in technology. And they mm-hmm. want to go through their local career and technical education center to gain some skills for that. It could be someone who's interested in going back to college, but they haven't gone to college ever, and they just want to try taking a course or two to see if they can be successful at it before they actually go through the more rigorous process of applying to college and applying for financial aid. They can use mm-hmm. advancement grants. We also see people who, even in the job they're in, they need additional skills in order to be successful. So they're not trying to change jobs. They just want to be able to advance in the job they have. You see that a lot, quite frankly, in the nursing field, where somebody might start out as an LNA, then want to move to an LPN, and then perhaps move to having their RA. And
RN,
thank you. So those first step from to become an LNA, and then maybe to move forward, may be done with an advancement grant at some training programs. So if anyone is interested in training, this is another place where the legislature gave VSAC additional money, thinking that we could end up with a number of Vermonters that need new skills in order to become employed again, especially if the job that they had because of COVID virus is no longer available to them. So there's funding for that, and that's a fairly simple online application that someone can fill out. It's not as onerous as the FAFSA, so it's a little easier for folks, and usually within 10 days we can tell someone whether or not they're eligible, which, again, from an adult student's point of view, makes sense, because high school students tend to know as they're graduating from high school that they're going to go to college in September. So they're filling those forms out in January and February. Adults very seldom know 8 months before school starts that they're going to need a training program. They're usually finding out or figuring that out within a month or two, or even a week or two of starting class. So this program was designed to be able to respond to that shorter time frame, and also to remove some of the barriers that adult students might face in trying to get back into school.
Let's go to another listener calling in. I believe it's Jim from Barrytown, from Barry. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Hey, thank you. I was a student loaner. I had to get a loan after I graduated from Spalding High School. And I want to ask the person there that you're interviewing. This was back in the 70s, and I was a little reluctant to pay the loan off, but I finally did because they would withhold my tax returns, and so I paid up. So I called your office recently at the student loan, you know, that place, and how come I can't get a letter acknowledging that I successfully paid my loan off? And I know it's from the 70s, and here we are, you know, dinosaur age, kind of. But why can't you even acknowledge with my Social Security number that I paid off my student loan?
Wow, that's that was when did you finally pay it off?
Oh, I paid it off in the 80s, because when I filed tax returns, then I cut a deal with you guys. You were in Winooski, right, Mrs.?
Yes.
This is Marilyn Cargill,
yes.
My guest.
Yeah.
She's a vice president at VSAC.
Yeah, so why can't I get a letter generated saying that I successfully met the demands and paid off my student loan?
You know, I think that's a fair question that I don't know the answer to without being able to look at your account and see what's going on. So what I'd like to do is give you my direct phone number so you can call me or you can email me, and I can have somebody look at your account and I can get back to you. So I just don't have the information as I'm sitting here on the radio to be able to answer that question, but I am more than happy to look into it for you. So let me give you my direct number. Do you have a pencil
okay,
with
you
or a pen?
Thank
sure.
you. Go ahead.
Okay, the number is 802-542-2201. Or
okay, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, or you can email me if that's easier for you at Cargill, which is my last name, C-A-R-G-I-L-L, the @ at VSAC, VSAC.org.
Okay, now you're all automated right now. In other words, if a person called live, on the phone like I'm on the radio right now. If they called your office, do they get marched through a lot of hoops, or do they get a real person?
So what? When you call me, Jim, I'm going to either get your information and have someone do the research for me, or I'm going to have someone call you directly so that you can talk with one of our loan advisors.
That's great. And I know that a lot of people from the 70s skirted around repaying student loans, and they were into it like for $30,000 and this and that. But I paid it off, and I'd like a letter from you people saying that I successfully did it.
All right. I get that. Thank you for the call, Jim. And that's an interesting case there. I guess I wonder whether the Marilyn Cargill, can you tell if this is a common thing, and is it normal? Do people routinely get a letter saying you have successfully completed paying off your student loan, or is that something that only comes of maybe with a special request or something?
No, actually, when someone has paid their loan in full, we are quite excited to be able to send the letter out to them that says, congratulations, your loan is now paid in full. It's similar to when you pay off your car loan or your house loan, that you get an acknowledgement that that loan obligation has now been met. So, again, you know, it's the fact that this gentleman, this caller, has not received that letter. I just need to look into it and see. I don't know what the problem might be, but I'm more than happy to look into it. But yeah, we send a letter because, again, you had a legal obligation to repay a student loan, and it has now been paid in full. And so we're acknowledging that those promissory notes have now that promissory note has now been met. So it's similar to any other type of loan that we would send that out.
Well, I'll tell you, part of me almost wants to crack up a little bit because, well, I guess we're talking about a payoff that the gentleman tells us, Jim tells us, that occurred back in the 1980s. And it's funny to learn about sort of clerical things or things that need to be cleared up like this from 30 or 40 years ago. I had a lot of the folks who were patients of various parts of the UVM medical network use this thing called MyChart, where you can go online and sort of look at your own health history and so on and so forth. And I have a reminder on there that I was supposed to go to a preventative medical appointment on March 14th, 1974.
I think I've got
Jim beat there. March 14th, 1974, which I would have been, I think like my 18th birthday or something like that. And, go ahead.
Your point is a great one, Dave. We actually do have online access. I'm not sure we have online access for accounts that are 40 or 50 years old. That probably is stretching it a little. But
yeah,
we do have online access for students who are currently borrowing with us, or even for students who are taking out their state grants from us. You can go online through what we refer to as MyVSAC and access your loan and grant information. So there's a great way for students to see what's happening with their accounts on any time basis that works for them. Everyone has their own hours when they like to do that kind of work, and it's not always normal office hours. So that is out there for them. So, you know, I do want to just pivot back for a moment, if we can, to this idea of appealing your financial aid. I just think it's so critically important that Vermonters
How do people do that?
Know they have this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
How do people do that? Yeah. Start to kick off that process.
How do they do that? So what they can do, they can either call VSAC at 1-800-882-4166 and speak to one of our counselors, or they can do what I just mentioned a moment ago and go into My VSAC, and on their account is going to be the form, especially if they want to appeal their income. They want to use their 20 income instead of their 18. there is a form that's on their state grant application already waiting for them. And they can go right through my DSAC into their account and access that. If they have any problems, call that toll-free number, and we will have a counselor that can help them with that. And if it's, you know, even if you're not sure and you just want to talk this through with somebody, definitely give us a call. I mean, the whole purpose of DSAC is to make sure that Vermont's families have the, you know, the information as well as the financial aid that they need to be successful in school. And this year,
all right, well,
thanks to the legislature, we have extra money for them.
Marilyn Cargill, we're about out of time. Vice President with the VSAC, thank you very much for joining me this morning. And that is about it for today's Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for the governor's press conference on the COVID-19 response. And we'll talk to you all Monday morning. Have a good weekend, people.